About, we're studying the book of Samuel. I'm on page 88. I'm on 1 Samuel 25, 1 through 8. I call this chapter, David Meets a Fool with a Good Wife. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. It came about that while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. Now, if my wife were editing this, Samuel would never get away with the way they put this together. But anyway, go on. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life, peace be to you. Peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. And now I have heard that you have shearers, that your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David. All right, so Samuel dies, and David moves much further south to get farther away from Saul. He's in the wilderness of Paran. If you had your maps from last week, not that you needed to, but it's just further south than where we were last week, or where the circle was, the wilderness of Paran. And he hears that this guy Nabal is shearing sheep in Carmel, or Carmel. It's Carmel if you're in California. It's Carmel if you're a Catholic, because that's the Carmel nuns, Carmelite nuns. Anyway. And David's presence has been a hedge of protection for Nabal and his neighbors. All right, so when these people who lived on the wilderness did so for a variety of reasons. One was is to get away from the big cities. Another was is it was a very inexpensive way to have the land that you needed to accomplish what you wanted to do. And remember, a wilderness is not a desert. A wilderness grows and blooms when it has water. And it's only dry when there's no water. So it has seasons. And during those seasons, when it blooms, it's fertile. And so what happened is it's a good place to raise sheep and everything, and then you got to hay in some stuff for the, you know, dry times and whatever. When people were in New York in the first part of our country, they thought of Kentucky as the wilderness. Okay, so a wilderness is not a desert. So these people are living out here. They're like the people who went to Kentucky. They're away from civilization. They're away from towns. They're away from government interference. They're out there where they can not be bothered by all kinds of stuff. They can get lands free and cheap, just like when people move from the east to Kentucky, Indiana, whatever. The problem is when you're in the wilderness, you are more at risk to marauders. The closer you live to town, the more sheltered you are, protected from marauders. In the wilderness, you know, it's like the Indians who used to come through once in a while, and there'd be a small clearing with a couple of families, and they would just get wiped out, you know, because that's why they would build forts and ring the bell, and everybody runs to the forts, because they had to find ways to protect themselves. Well, one of the benefits of having David running away from Saul was wherever he was, he acted as a safety barrier, a buffer against all these various marauders. If people were being attacked by somebody, they would send for David, and David and his men would come out, and he would rescue them and do all manner of things. There's a number of stories about that in the scriptures. We already read a couple of them. We're going to read some more. But so David acted as a kind of an unofficial Robin Hood and his merry band kind of a protectorate for these people. And it was a feast day, and he hears that this man Nabal, who's got 3,000 sheep, which, by the way, would be a lot of sheep for that time, and, you know, whatever, that he's shearing, and it's a feast day coming up, usually associated with the harvest and stuff. There's always sort of thing. And so David has sent some young men up, hat in hand, saying, "Would you mind giving us some stuff for our, you know, for our feast? Because we're soldiers, we're not shepherds, and we need something for the feast. Would you be willing to donate?" And the bottom line is that everybody out there knew that they were protected by these people. They paid no taxes to David or anything, and so people would give David and his men stuff from time to time, because David and them had done all that for them. So this was a simple request: Would you do this? Well, Nabal was an idiot. His name means fool, and he was a fool. All of that. So 1 Samuel 25:9. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name, and then they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" It's the closest things to SOB you can get. Okay. So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and they told him according to these words, all these words. And David said to his men, "All right, everybody put on your sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. About 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed back with the baggage. And others stayed back with the luggage. They protected what was called the van. Whenever they were on the march, all their stuff would go with them, and what that was called was the van. That's everything, whatever. And these people were the vanguard, okay? So left 200 back. That'll come into play in another chapter later. So Nabal, whose name means fool, gives them a harsh answer. He insults David's lineage and calls him and his men brigands. David's initial response is to mount up a troop of men and go remove Nabal's foolish head from him. He takes 400 men. 1 Samuel 25. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, David's men, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. There was a wall. They were a wall to us both day and night, and all the time we were with them tending sheep. Now, therefore, no one consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master, against all his household. He is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 jugs of wine, 5 sheep already prepared, and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I'm coming after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain, behold, David and his men were coming up, were coming down toward her, and so she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed and all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any of them who belong to him." So David is angry. He's steamed, I guess is a good way to say it. Abigail has been living with Nabal for some time. She's got children with him. She's probably one of 4 or 5 wives that he's got. And it's a feast day, and they've been preparing for all of these people. So they have tables full of food ready for this, being prepared for tomorrow morning's feast or whatever it is. And when she hears this, she grabs a whole bunch of it up and sticks it on pack donkeys and starts heading down to see David. She quickly gathers food and supplies and goes to meet David. She purposely does not tell Nabal what she's doing. David is coming well-armed and muttering threats. He remembers the many times he's defeated. He has defended Nabal's sheep, and he swears out he's going to wipe out his male line. David is living, to use a nice churchy word, and Samuel is no longer alive to appeal to David's better nature. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey, and she fell on her face before David. She bowed herself to the ground, and she fell at his feet, and she said, "On me alone, my lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you, and listen to the words of your maidservant." Please do not let my lord pay attention to this worthless man Nabal, for as is his name, so he is. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my lord be as Nabal. And now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who accompany my lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. So she quickly says, look, please don't pay attention to my husband. He's an idiot. She says, this is my fault. I did not see the young men coming, or I would have cared for them. But I didn't see them, and it didn't happen, so blame me. Don't blame the idiot. She said, I would have done this if I had. He has no clue about how to do stuff like this. She said there that don't sully yourself. You know, it would demean you to kill such a one as Nabal. He's, you know, it'd be like you stepping on a worm or something on the thing. There's nothing noble about that. This is a good woman stuck in a bad marriage, which she undoubtedly did not choose, but of which she is trying to make the best. Remember, this is the age in the world of arranged marriages. Women that day had little authority or power, but women exercised a great deal of influence and usually were responsible for improving their husband and his image in the community over time. One of the things that women did is they sort of mellowed him out and shaped him up and cleaned him up a little bit and got him to thinking along right ways and whatever, and helped him to grow up some. She is well representative of the Proverbs lady. She accomplishes her goals while yet under the thumb of an idiot, churlish husband. Now, this is a very good example of how women could behave in this world and how God rewarded women for behaving in this world, how he expected women to behave in this world, and when they didn't, why they came under judgment. In Isaiah 3, which I call the Dillard's chapter, some of y'all heard this Sunday, but some of you heard it before anyway. Isaiah has told the men and women of Israel, it's the third chapter, it's early. He's told the men and women of Israel that time is up, their judgment's come upon them, they're going into captivity, there's nothing they can do about it, blah, blah, blah. And he goes to systematically lays out what they've all done and all the various stuff with that. And then in verse 13 of Isaiah 3, it says, the Lord arises to contend, and he stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord of hosts. This is strong wording. He said, what do you mean not caring for my poor? What do you mean? How do you think that you can get away with this? What are you thinking? God is angry. He rises to contend. This example here is known as God in the dock. It shows up a number of places in Scripture. It says God arises to contend. It's called God in the dock. A dock is what they call a British court. And this is God rising in the dock in the British court and bringing a legal charge against a defendant who is on trial for his life. It's called God in the dock. Now he's already had a whole bunch to say, but then he says this in verse 16. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go about with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. Generally speaking, God does not chew out or fuss at or rebuke the women because they don't have the first line authority. They have no authority at all. But he doesn't hold them directly responsible like this. He very seldom chastises women like this. But in this particular case, what he's saying is this society of yours, Israel, has gotten really prosperous. Everything is rolling, hunky-dory, happy days are here, whatever. Prosperity is the name of the game. And the people have chased after prosperity and abandoned God. And the process, they've abandoned the poor. Now, one of the things that was going on at this particular time is God had put a number of laws in Israel to prevent them from forming a permanent underclass. So, for instance, if you lost your farm, then after a certain period of time, the man had to give it back to you so that your descendants would have the farm. You couldn't permanently lose your farm, either a seven-year period or the year of Jubilee. So no one could permanently lose their farm or that sort of thing. If there was, when you harvested, you were not to glean the edges and you were not to glean the fields. You're supposed to leave the edges alone and not glean the fields. That was because when you got done going through collecting what is the lion's share of it, then the poor could come and pick. They could glean the fields and pick the edges and take what they made and go to the town and sell it or eat it or whatever. It was a type of workfare instead of welfare. It was a kind of a workfare program. And there were these rules in Israel to prevent them from becoming a permanent underclass. By the time we get here, it's 742 B.C. It's the 8th century. David's gone. Solomon's gone. And there are now in Israel corrupt kings after the fashion of Ahab with like Jezebel, whatever, who have learned the ways of the pagan kingdoms around them. Jezebel was the Sidonian witch and the daughter of the king of Tyre. And Ahab's father, Manasseh, I guess, or Omri, one is Omri. Ahab's father knew that Ahab was weak, so he purposely married him off, and Omri was an evil man. He married him off to Jezebel, the daughter of the king of Tyre, because he knew that she put some backbone in. Well, she taught him all kinds of evil things to do. And remember when Elijah was forbidding there to be rain? It was Ahab and Jezebel that he was doing with. Anyway, so what happened is we are now in a time in Israel's history when evil kings have conspired with evil judges and changed the law so that big corporations like Dole Pineapple could come into an area and buy up all the small farms, kick the farmers off, and own them forever. They manipulate them to make that happen. And then you had all these people who were homeless and didn't have a place to live, whatever, and they would migrate to the cities. And in the cities, they would take whatever work they could find. And they became aliens in their own country. So what happened is this whole permanent underclass was it. And God had enough. There are two great commandments. So love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and body. Love your neighbor as yourself. And the punishment for failing to keep the first commandment is you develop eyes that can't see and ears that can't hear. You become spiritually stupid. You begin to think that what's right is wrong and what's wrong is right. You can no longer hear God because he's no longer first. You're not having the intimate relationship, not a conversation. So you begin to get spiritually stupid, and you do a lot of stupid things, and that causes you a lot of judgment. But when you violate the second commandment about not caring for your neighbor, then what happens is that whatever is done to you, whatever you did to them, will be done to you. It's the golden rule. That is the violation, that is the penalty for violating the second commandment, either abusing or failing to care for the poor. And so what happens is you can count on it. When people do not care for their poor, they eventually get hauled off into captivity. That's very literal. They actually get hauled off to Babylon or Assyria. Sometimes what happens is their culture becomes so alien to them that they feel like they're in captivity, but they've never left home. All of a sudden, they who used to be sort of in control of their life and everybody had agreed what was right and wrong. Now they find all of the things they believe in to be hostile to all the larger culture around them, and they have become aliens, captives, without ever having moved. Walter Brueggemann said that Western society has become such a displacement as to be equal to a captivity. I didn't say that very well, but that's what he said. That there's that in our society, there is such a displacement. We don't feel like we're living in the same country we used to. And the reason is because we have violated the second great commandment. Big time. Major. You've heard me say this before, but before World War II, before the end of World War II, all health care, welfare, and education were done by individuals, communities, and churches. They did all of it. The government did none of it. There was no intervention of the government in any of these areas before that time. And then after the war, when Happy Days were here again and the government was trying to encourage consumerism and everything to get this new, remember they were, came out of depression, trying to get this economy going, whatever. And so they're stimulating consumerism and people begin to chase after all that and they begin to abandon taking care of other people because they're too busy chasing after wealth and whatever. And the government steps in and says, don't worry about it, we'll do it. So in the early 50s, they create the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Health, Education, and Welfare. And they began the process of the federal government systematically taking responsibility for health, education, and welfare. They take it off our hands, and we're all happy about that. We don't have to do it. Until suddenly we wake up one day and we realize they're controlling all of that. They're taking our money. They're wasting our money. They're not doing it right. They're taking all this money for it and still not getting done. And the reason that we have a culture that's now big government and the government's God, and they, not only do they want to take over that, they want to take over what you can believe and all that sort of thing. Well, the reason we have that is because we abandon our responsibility, our stewardship over health, education, and welfare in the 40s and in the 50s, late 40s and early 50s. We as a people did that. The predominant Christian world here did that. Now, there's always been people who are giving and all that kind of stuff. Well, it's no longer, we abandon it. And when we did, this is what we get. We got captivity. And we're not going to get out of this captivity until we take our responsibility up again and take it away from the government. Now, one of the things that we see happening in our world today, which is encouraging, is companies and individuals who are beginning to get philanthropic and go and do things out of the company's welfare and out of personal pockets, et cetera, et cetera. So we get people like Jackie and, what's your name?
Kitty,
Jackie and yeah, I was just kidding. Jackie and Kitty and whatever, out there organizing an effort to go care for the poor. And we jump in and help them with all of that and begin to take that on. Then if we begin to do that and that grows and whatever, it'll soon get to the place where it is the locals, the churches, individuals, companies, and local communities that are doing the health, education, and welfare, doing the benevolence, caring for the poor, the alien, the misfit, the orphans and widows. And when that happens, God will give us back our culture. But if it doesn't happen, he won't. We're lost. Just like Rome and Britain and all that went on before that. Now,
you know, Molly had a problem when he brought the first kids he had into his church area because the people that were already there did not want their children to be playing with them. And we ran into that down there where I feed the homeless because when the funds backed off out of the Methodist church because the funds were coming in less, the minister that was down there, Grace, was going to make them move. Because you have to deal with trash being in the yard when they're leaving, and you know, it's homeless people around. I mean, it's just part of where they are. But after being there almost 25 years, they were going to move, and they were finding a new place they were going to go. And we just kept praying about it because I was like, well, who's going to feed them? You know, and I was like, well, God's big, he can take care of it. Interestingly enough, the preacher that was there that was wanting all this moved, he left the church. And the new person that came in was just gangbusters, happy for us to be there. The room we were in was about a fourth of the size of this room. And now the room we're in is, what, three times the size of this? And the new lady said, y'all come and use our fellowship hall. So instead of bumping into each other all over the place, I mean, God really blessed it. But we need to examine our hearts when the church wants to do something and not look down our noses.
What you're looking at is a competing vision for mm-hmm. what the church ought to be doing.
Right.
The one guy was saying, we need to dress our church up, get a better class of people in here,
yeah.
get all of these riffraff out of here that are making the thing ugly. How can we expect people of substance and
exactly.
money to come and join our church when we got all this around? We need to clean all this out so that we can get a better group of clientele in here, have a better church and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's a vision. That's a vision of growing the church.
Mm-hmm.
But this other person comes in, they go, what is the church supposed to do? The church is supposed to care for people, et cetera, et cetera. It's good for us. It's part of our stewardship to reach out to this particular people, whatever. Here's somebody willing to do it. Let us encourage them. Yes, please.
Very similar what's happened up at Union Chapel. The new minister that came in like 3 years ago has come in, and now he's got members of the church that are cooking and serving
yeah.
and are the hands and
mm-hmm.
feet so that so many of us who've been in there cooking stuff, we don't have to do quite as much.
Yeah,
and
it's made
a big difference.
If we teach our people that their job is to memorize scripture and go out and make other people kneel down and say words, and that is their job. If we teach them that that's what they're supposed to do, or that, you know, there's all this church stuff, and we don't emphasize that they're supposed to go care for the poor, then that's what the people are going to do. So the vision of ministry has to change. You know, one of the reasons that we go to Mount Pisgah is because of the outreach of this church. This church has a very, very good outreach. It's not that we couldn't do more,
yeah.
but by comparison, it's a very good outreach. And we... The definition of ministry is important. And until these churches, we as Christian churches in this country, get a much wider spread vision of ministry that says we're supposed to do this, this, and this. You know, one of the things that happened was a lot of what we were doing got sucked away when the religious right came in and said, what you really ought to be doing is politics. And they said, you want to feed the poor, whatever? Let's get somebody voted in, right? Ronald Reagan will feed the poor, you know? Well, it was demonic. It moved all of our emphasis off of what we were doing that was right, onto we were seduced by the political crowd, the right wing conservatives. We were seduced to come in and give all of our efforts to them to get their candidates elected with the promise that it was going to be, whatever. It was just BS. You know, these Ralph Reed and Jim McAteer and Phyllis Schlafly and what's that? Dr. Dobson, all these kind of people, all they cared about was politics. They didn't care about people. They didn't care about people at all. But they talked a good game. And we just followed right along. Oh, Dr. Dobson, he's got a great book on how to raise a bad kid, so he must be really good. You know, I mean, so that's all give to American family, whatever his thing was. You know, Phyllis Schlafly, she's thought of as a really powerful woman in the churches. You know, she must be good. Let's do what she's doing. You know, Ralph Reed, he's a godly young man, let's do this. And so we followed after him like lemmings and watched our culture go right over the cliff with him because we abandoned the call from God that we clearly have here. We have a call. It's the same call we've always had, and we abandon it. Now, that's sort of prophetic sounding. It's sort of, you know, ugly Jeremiah-like sounding, but that's the truth. Well, I'm going to go here. Verse 18 of chapter 3 of Isaiah. He's fussing at the women. He's saying to the women of Israel, I'm going to, you who are so into perfume and all that, I'm going to bring you out. Your scalp is going to get full of lice. Then I'm going to cut off all your hair, top to bottom, every inch of it. I'm going to put sackcloth around you, rope you together, and march you all the way to Babylon. He said, that's after you've seen your men killed and your sons castrated. The truth of the matter is that I cannot give you a clear translation of what he said to these women in a public place. What he said to these women was almost profane. So it was stuff you don't talk about in a mixed company. But then he said, in that day, verse 18, the Lord will take away the beauty, and I call this the Dillard's chapter. The Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, their headbands, their crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. It's like he's walking through the women's department at Dillard's and saying, "This is where you worship. This is where you worship, women of Israel." As opposed to, you know, being prosperous and having stuff you need, but doing your real duty, which is to care for the poor and to influence your culture around you to good works. So what happened is that women very often through history have been a buffer against the bad behaviors of men. They haven't had much power, but they've often been so influential, like Abigail, that they were actually able to step in and move everything in the right direction. They had influence. The Greeks like to say that the man is the head of the home, but the wife is the neck. That's because the Greek word for wife is gynekos. And so they're making a play on words. The wife is the neck. So the man's the head, but it's the wife that turns in his head to where it's supposed to go. And they have this influence. And when they abandon that influence to go chase after goods and services and pleasure and fun and whatever, and don't do these things, then that the last line of defense is gone. The last line of defense is gone. So he goes on to say, it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth. A branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword, your mighty ones in battle. Her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. He's angry. So, Abigail. Abigail is a woman who has a godly heart. She's stuck in a bad marriage. She's stuck with what she's got. She's making the best of it. She's doing the best she can to be supportive and whatever. And she sees that her husband, who's an idiot, has just done something that's going to get the entire family slaughtered, including her sons. And so she goes and she kneels down in front of David and she says, "It's my fault. It's my fault. Don't take it on him. You know, whatever." I said she was like the Proverbs lady. Proverbs 31, 10 to 31 is Solomon's tribute to an excellent wife. An excellent wife who can find. In other words, they're rare, but they're there. "For her worth is far above jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax. It works with her hands in delight. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it's still night, and she gives food to her household and portions to her maidens." This is not a woman who's doing this by herself. She has maidens who do work for her. She has a staff of people. She oversees. If her husband is the head man, then all the people who report to him, she's managing their wives. She's organizing all of this. "She considers a field and buys it." This is not some wimpy woman who has no power or authority. She may not have the ultimate power or authority, but she has plenty of sphere. "She considers a field and buys it." What is she buying the field with? "With earnings, with her earnings. From her earnings, she plants a vineyard." This woman is making stuff and selling it and making money and buying stuff. She's very active in improving the well-being and the welfare of her family. She girds herself with strength and she makes her arms strong. "She senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff. Her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. She stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all of her household are clothed scarlet." This is not a poor woman. This is a woman who's prosperous. This woman lives in Alpharetta. There's nothing wrong with living in Alpharetta. They're not living in sackcloth and ashes. "She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when she sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and she sells them and supplies belts to tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her, her husband also. And he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. So if you want a good divinely defined view of a woman in the Old Testament, here's one. And Abigail is like that woman. So she says to David, please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house. The Lord in heaven will certainly make for my Lord, meaning you, David, an enduring house. Because my Lord, that's you, David, is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall be found not be found in you all your days. And should anyone rise up to pursue you and seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound to the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. It should come about when the Lord shall do for my Lord according to all that is good that he has spoken concerning you, and shall appoint you ruler over Israel, that this will not cause grief or troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and my Lord having avenged himself. When you're king, and all of Israel's looking to you, and he gives you leadership, and you're sitting at the top of the world, you won't have to be ashamed of having massacred this idiot and his men today. This won't be on, you know, think about what you're doing. I wish that you wouldn't have this stain on you. When the Lord shall deal well with my Lord, remember your maidservant. And by the way, when you are in a good place of leadership, don't forget me. Okay? There's a reason for this. We'll get to this. All right. She's making the point that revenge on Nabal is beneath David's dignity. David is a man destined for greatness, and Nabal is too small to require David's time or attention. Nabal's blood on David's sword would dishonor him. God has plans for David, so David should not soil himself by taking petty revenge on Nabal. David would regret it later, and others would think less of David for such a deed. David will later be glad he did not avenge himself, but that he let God fight his battles for his honor. P.S. Don't forget me when God does destroy my husband. She knows that Nabal will not live long on the earth. He's too stupid to survive his own foolishness. Her counsel is as wise as any that Samuel would have given. Abigail also knows that she will need a protector when Nabal is gone, so that she does not wind up a slave in some brigand's harem, and her sons as eunuchs or dead men. To think about the reality here. When Nabal dies, there's going to be a scramble for power. If he's foolish as he looks like, and he's not prepared well for his succession, all manner of things can happen. And what is likely to happen is Nabal's wives are going to be booty for whoever comes and takes it over. And she's going to wind up in some less than wonderful place. And her sons are going to wind up in some less than wonderful scenario. Remember what happened when David made Solomon king. Remember before all that, Adonijah and Absalom are both trying to become king, and there was this struggle, and their mothers were all politicking so that their son would become king. Because one of the things that happens when somebody becomes king is they very often got rid of all their competition. They would go in and eliminate them. Or they would put them in some place where they were way under their thumb somewhere. So if you won that contest, it's good for you. But if you lost it, there was dire consequences. If it was like Absalom, and Absalom did not go out and kill all of his brothers off, then that was fortunate. And when Adonijah tried to take it over and he got killed, it was his own fault. When Absalom tried to take it over and he got killed, it was his own fault. But, you know, David had 18 sons, and three of them were dead by the time this happened. So there was 13 sons that Solomon didn't kill. On the other hand, if you think about the story that we read a long time ago about Gideon, when Gideon died, the son of his concubine rose up and killed all 70 of his sons and enslaved all of their families when he took over. And that was common. So she's saying, by the way, when all this happens, please remember me. Please remember me. And David says to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you, who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself on my own hand. You know, it's easy for any and all of us to blow our stack and go out and do something foolish. And it seems to be particularly typical of men to do this. You can never generalize completely, but one of the things that wives are often very good at is settling you down so that you don't go do something stupid. My wife is. I have this tendency from time to time to get really upset about something, and she has this way of appealing to my better nature, and sometimes she suffers for it in the sense that I'm not immediately receptive to her idea. But she has been a modifier for me all of our life in many ways, and has caused us to have a happy home and a peaceful home and whatever. She's like this Proverbs lady. A good wife who can find. So, at any rate, where am I here? So, let's see here.
34.
What verse am I in?
34.
30 what?
34. That's the top page.
31.
34.
34.
Okay. Well, if I turn my hearing aid on so I can hear you, then it'll be like shouting. Okay. 34. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left to Nabal, even until the morning light, as much as one male. So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you, and I've granted your request. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. The feast day had started, and he was partying. And Nabal's heart was merry with him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. Came about in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, what had happened. And he realizes how close he had come to getting slaughtered, and everything he had slaughtered. His heart died within him so that he became as a stone. About 10 days later, it happened that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. So David praises her for her discernment. She kept him from defiling vengeance, blah, blah. David would have slaughtered Nabal's entire lineage, which theoretically could have included her own sons. David accepts her gifts, tells her to go in peace. Talk about this, the rest of this. Nabal has a heart attack, goes into a coma, and dies 10 days later.
That's an interesting description there. His heart died within him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a
yeah, it's but Hebrew is a beautiful language if you understand that it's that the Bible, the Old Testament, is 80-some% poetry. All this stuff that we read that looks like prose, it's poetry. And I'll tell you one thing that happens when I go to take a scripture from my computer program and I drop it into a text. Very often it's lined up with capitals at the end of each sentence because it's poetry. And I have to take all of that and bend it around to make it look like it does here, to make it look like prose, because it's beautiful. The images are beautiful. Now, the thing is that it gives you trouble if you're looking at that poetry as if it's, you know, the formula for hydrogen peroxide, or if it's scientific or whatever. If you don't understand the poetic, what's on being said poetically, you can get very confused. And so part of the study of the Old Testament or the New Testament is the study of the languages that they're in, the metaphors and idioms of the language they're in, and the forms that were used by the people of the day when that language was written. So much of the confusion that surrounds people's notions about the Bible are the failure to go deeper than just the English word-for-word translation that someone has given it. That, you know, the first lesson that I had in seminary, and I had some stuff in seminary that was really good. The first lesson I had in seminary was a class on biblical interpretation. And the man says that it's got to come from the mouth of God through the mind and culture of the prophet into your culture and then into you. but it's got to pass through their culture and through your culture to get to you, or else you won't get it. If you just take it from the prophet straight to yourself, you'll miss a whole bunch of what's there. But yes, it is beautiful. These images are beautiful. I don't know if you know this about Hebrew, but in Hebrew, all words are three consonant verbs. And then they hang other letters and stuff on it to create nouns or nounal type words to make them into nouns or noun forms. And if you look at a sentence in English, and let's say it's 20 words long, in which case Nancy made me write it in two sentences, but let's say it's 20 words long, it might be displayed in seven characters, in seven words, because these words are used to describe things. And we try to make it into a prosaic definition. So, like, for instance, if you're looking at Strong's Concordance, Strong's Concordance is the ultimate biblical concordance for Hebrew in particular, has been for many, many years. But if you have an interlinear program, either on your computer or if you buy an interlinear Bible, you'll see the English word and English word verbiage, and underneath it you will see the Hebrew. And what happens is that for every English word between there, you'll see a number. And that number tells you which Hebrew word from Strong's you're supposed to go to. Well, very often you'll see the number 9999. And that number means it's not in the text. This word is not in the text. It was when the person was translating this, they had to use these words to fill out or flesh out what was being intended here. So the understanding of the Hebrew it's an art, and it requires. That's why one of the things we say about Hebrew is words only mean what they mean in context, because a word can mean one thing in one context and another thing in another context. And you have to take the Bible not only in the individual context of the sentence, but the Bible throughout. So, for instance, throughout the Bible, we're told that we should love our parents. So when Jesus says we should hate our parents, or he says that unless we hate our parents, we can't enter the kingdom of heaven, that is totally out of context with everything else the Bible says. So why? Why is that? Well, the answer is that the word mizio, which is the Greek word that is translated hate, has a number of meanings, but one of its meanings is to love less or to prioritize lower. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to a good concordance and you look up mizio, it'll say hate, despise, love less, prioritize lower, because it can mean any of those things depending on its context. So yes, that is, his heart died within him is a very good description. And then he died 10 days. He was in a coma for 10 days. He became a stone, and then he died 10 days later. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from evil. I'm glad I didn't go in and do what I was thinking about doing, because I would have looked stupid. It would have been wrong. I would have had to deal with it. It would have sullied my reputation. The Lord has also returned the evil doing of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. Wonder how long it took for her to accept that one. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, "David has sent us to you to take you as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your maidservant is a maid to wash the feet of my Lord's servants." Then Abigail quickly arose and rode on a donkey with her five maidens who attended her, followed the messengers of David, and became his wife. David had also taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both became his wives. Now Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. Remember that Michal, we talked about Michal, his wife, earlier. After David had gone, Saul had given her to another man as a reward, one of his soldiers.
Now, wait a minute. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to the son of... How could he... Because I could have... two wives and two husbands and all that?
No, they can't have two husbands. Saul's king.
David, David's wife, Michal, had two husbands then, David and Paul.
No, you're missing what's going on. David is no longer her husband. He's king. He has canceled her marriage and given, it's his daughter, and given his daughter to another man. He has annulled the marriage. Now later on, years later, when David comes into power, he demands that Michal be restored to him. But there's nothing David could do about it, and there's nothing Michal can do about it. Saul just says,
I just missed all that.
Yeah. No, he just says, well, you know what?
That's a lot of intrigue.
David's dead to me. It's just a matter of time before he's dead. So, Michal, I'm giving you to Palti because he has had a really good success in battle, and he's your reward. Now, what happens is there's many years that pass between here and there, and Michal falls in love with Palti. And then later, when she's forced to go back to David, she goes back to him as a hostile wife because she has had a love of Palti and children with him. And, you know.
And that's when she criticizes David. That's when she's dancing in the streets.
That's right. So when David heard of Nabal's death, he praised God for saving him from defiling himself. He sent for Abigail to take her as his wife. There was a way to care for her as he promised. And she was a wise, warm woman worthy of his care. Now, she came with five maidens. We don't know how many children she came with. But this is not a village woman. This is a woman whose husband was rich, and there's quite a bit of substance here. She had five maidens. She could get all that spinning done and all that sort of thing. And then we're also told that Ahinoam of Jezreel also had become David's wife. These wives now replace Michal, Saul's daughter, who had been given by Saul to one of his friends, Palti, a Benjamite from Galim, near Saul's hometown. All's fair in love and war, right?
I have one question for you. So all these wives that he's taking, and are they still living in the wilderness? So they're just kind of in tents or whatever?
Well, they're in the wilderness in tents, or they're in the wilderness in caves. It depends on where in the wilderness they are. Yeah. Oh, these people can put together a mean cave.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But she was kind of going down from what she had when she was with the
idiot. Well, she would now. This is a good point. She's left the rich man's home where she had a really nice tent.
Right. You know,
and then she's moved into David's home, and he's not in a position at this point in time to provide for her. Now, he will later.
Right.
Later on, he's going to have palaces, and so will she. In Swaziland, the king has 18 wives. And what happens is, Swaziland's polygamous. And here's what happens when you are polygamous. One of two things happen. Your wives either live in a harem, which is a kind of a big building holding wives and children, and managed by servants of the king, all of whom are eunuchs, and all that sort of thing. And then when the king wants one, he calls for her. What happens is that if their favorite wife, they have their own little palace. He actually builds them a little palace. The Queen of Sheba had her own palace built, and there's speculation about what their relationship was, although it's purely speculative. But in Swaziland, the first wife still lives in the king's palace. The other 18 are divided between two types. The three or four that are favorite, they have their own palace. When you drive around Swaziland, you've got these dirt roads, and all of a sudden you'll see a concrete road, blacktop road, going through a fence with electrical up to a big house, whatever. Then that's a queen. That's one of the queen's residences. And they come and go in their Mercedes, okay? But the vast majority of them live in rondavos. So a man in Swaziland who is poor and takes on a second wife, he has to build her a rondavo. Rondavo is a little round house with a thatched roof with a point on it, because it is considered immoral to keep both wives in the same house. Okay? So, they got standards. Well, in some parts of Utah, they give them their own trailer.
Well, that would help.
Yeah. So, So the point is that, so you can drive down the road in Swaziland and you can see some sort of flat roof kind of a house, looks like a shack. And next to it is a Rendalvo and another Rendalvo and another Rendalvo. You can, and if you go to a certain places, you can see a Rendalvo with an air conditioner sticking out the window, depending on how well off this particular guy is. So when she comes to be David's wife, she'll have her own quarters, and she's got five maidens. Theoretically, she doesn't forget to bring her tent with her when she comes, you know.
What about all the sheep and everything that Nabal had?
We're not told how the division is. Okay. Since David didn't kill all of his sons, that probably all was divided up by his sons and whatever. That would be the common thing to do. But we just know that he offered Abigail the opportunity to be his wife, and she accepted. It was not uncommon for the son who inherited to take on his wife's father's wives as his wife. You remember the story of Absalom, how he was told to take 10 of David's concubines and have sex with them on the roof in public so everybody would know that he would become king? Remember that story? It was very common for that. Henry VIII married Catherine of Aragon, who was actually the wife of his brother Arthur. But Arthur died before they even got to consummate. So he married her, and that cemented that he was the king, because he married the wife of the previous king. And that happens a lot in history.
So we assume then that the son gave permission for Abigail to go be David's.
Or not.
But she left.
Yeah, she left. Yeah, we don't need to assume that. David's quite capable of, if Abigail wants to come, David's quite capable of defending that. And the other thing is it eliminates the need for the son to care for that branch of the family. I mean, he's now got to care for all these people.
Right.
So we don't see that there's any objection to the son there. We don't know. Other comments?
We went to Africa. Mr. O, that taught computer sciences, he was from Kenya. And he left to take his son to go meet his grandmother that he'd never met before in Kenya. But he told me he went to see a friend that had his own tribe. And it was very much like what you were talking about. But two things that were interesting is the first wife was not the favored wife. But the first wife had to have the biggest amount of square footage in the home. Didn't matter if she was favored or not. And he said, I had to be very careful that when I went, his friend had told him, do not give her, he had to give her a present because that was expected. But he was bringing his friend some money and he said, do not give the money to her. Give her money to the trusted wife. So he said he had to watch his clock and watch and be sure he spent more time with the first wife than he did with the second wife. I mean, there are just all these rules about that. And they had the little huts all around, too.
Yeah.
But it was interesting.
Who would you say this was?
This, you know, Mr. Otero, he taught computer sciences.
No, I don't know.
At DeVry.
Oh, yes, I did. I met him when Charles was here. We took Charles over there, and they talked to each other.
Nice man.
Yeah.
One of the most encouraging men I've ever. I mean, you could tell that was his gift.
Yeah.
Just encouraged.
Yes, you're right. He was that way. He and Charles had a nice time together. Other comments?
Are we meeting next week?
We are. We'll be back, God willing, on Saturday night and ready for Sunday and Monday classes.
Yeah. I wish all of y'all a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Everybody enjoy yourself and your families and whatever. Anybody else got anything? Somebody press out there.